State Department in the late 1940s. Someone just asked me whether there's any indication that Harry Truman actually saw any of the famous letters that Ho Chi Minh had sent or communications to the State Department or the White House beginning in early 45 and down to late 45 and early 46. I told him that I had no confirmation that Truman saw any of the letters, but an interesting note is in the file, and that is, if I remember correctly, some of these things I have on my computer back home, sometime around late 1945, there had already been six or seven of these communications, and apparently some of them had been sent to the White House, or they were directed to the White House, whether Truman saw them or not, and the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, might have been Western Europe, I don't remember the flow chart at that particular point in the State Department, made a plea to the Secretary of State and said, let's not bother the White House anymore with these communications from Ho Chi Minh. And that was the decision that was made. So, in fact, after a certain point, those letters that are so famous were not sent to the White House at all. And they were derailed, as I said, specifically by the European Division. I don't remember exactly what date, but it was sometime in the late fall or 45 or early 1946. I will try to keep my comments fairly brief because you're probably pretty tired. I know by experience long days in workshops can be tiring. Let me fairly briefly talk to you about the second part of what I deal with in this particular section, and that is the nature of the colonial regime. What I dealt with before was the process of colonial takeover, or the process of colonial expansion, and I consider that as about half or a little more than half of that section that deals with the Vietnamese initial contact with the West. And the second half, approximately, is in the way in which the colonial regime actually operated. What I do, for whatever use it is to I separate colonial policy from the Vietnamese response. I find that personally, it's easier to deal with students who don't have a lot of experience in a lot of these things to sort of clearly indicate what I'm talking about at any particular point. So I'll say, now I'm going to talk about the nature of the system. I don't talk about the Vietnamese response until after that. Of course, gets into the rise of Vietnamese nationalism and the resistance movements, and that's something we'll talk about tomorrow. Colonial regime, certainly one of the things that I tell them is that if there are two major forces that it's important for anyone to know about if he wants to understand why Vietnam became the issue that it did in global politics. If one is, of course, if you need to understand traditional Vietnamese society and those forces operating within Vietnamese society. The second thing, obviously, is the impact of French colonialism. It's a way, obviously, of trying to get them to think that this is something important in the course. And the way I divide up this period, which let me say here that I usually use about two or three class periods on this particular issue. I'm a little vague on this because sometimes I teach 50-minute periods and other times 75-minute ones. And sometimes it depends on how much discussion that we get into. Some classes respond a lot to this and others don't. But I usually start out with a section on what I call the philosophy of colonialism. By that I mean, what is it that the French thought they were doing? What was their philosophy of colonialization? And Indochina, but French Indochina is a substantial part of it. And I find it very useful in getting into the way in which the French saw their goals in Indochina. And I, again, as I mentioned before, I find it a way to introduce ideas about what we were trying to achieve in Vietnam many, many years after that. The cutting edge of French conceptualization of their colonial philosophy was built into the two words, assimilation and association. The idea of assimilation, the idea behind assimilation was the belief in, essentially, in the universal man, that the French task in Indochina, as in its other colonies, was to introduce the colonial peoples to the very best of French civilization and to, there's a word to francicize them, but in any case to Europeanize them, to wean them from what were considered to be their own backward traditional culture, cultural ideas and practices, and to make, as they would say, Français de couleur, colored Frenchmen. The idea of association was, if not a polar opposite, certainly it was a very distinctly different theory that, for one reason or another, it was not advisable or possible to transform the Vietnamese into Français de couleur, into little brown Frenchmen, to use the American phrase, little brown Americans, about Filipinos. But rather, it was necessary to associate with the Vietnamese to allow them to retain their own national, traditional cultural characteristics, and to work out an equitable balance which would allow the French to achieve their economic and political goals in Indochina. For what it's worth, the students get pretty interested in this, because you can really talk about the whole philosophy of, you know, you can go beyond Indochina if you want to, and you can talk about what the United States did in the Philippines, you can talk about what we were trying to achieve in Vietnam, you can even introduce questions, if you want to, or to get them to think about it, connected, let's say, with the traditional treatment by the United States of the American Indian. What is it? How distinct are people? And the way I present this is, in effect, to say, as I believe, that the French, as a society, never really settled on one of these or another. There was a kind of flow of priorities in one side or the other at different times. And I mentioned the fact that at the outset, for example, when the French first arrived in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s, the tendency was very much in the direction of association. I think in good part because the early arrivals were simply out there to make their fortune. They weren't trying to remake anybody except for, let's say, the missionary elements. There was probably a hope on the part of some of the earlier administrators that they could work with the Vietnamese and work out an equitable arrangement where, in other words, the Vietnamese would serve as surrogates for the French. It was cheaper that way. It was easier. So the idea of association was simply a way of saying, you Vietnamese can keep your own society, at least in the center and the north, and we French will rake in the profits. Eventually, as I'm sure most of you know, a rising chorus of criticism developed inside France and to a lesser degree inside the colonies against this, because it was purely exploitative, and a lot of people said, you know, you're squeezing these people dry and you're not giving them anything. And you had, I'm not sure if I can find a word at this point, but, you know, the humanitarian impulse, which of course we in the United States have in spades, in terms of wanting to help other people, even if we don't always do it. Beginning in the early 20th century, you had a itself, of course, had its own built-in disadvantages. There was natural resistance on the part of the Vietnamese in the first place to destruction of their traditions. Equally to the point, the French really didn't take it very seriously. A lot of it was simply a kind of surface commitment that wasn't reflected in colonial policy in reality. Obviously, the bottom line is that as time passed in Indochina, particularly in Vietnam, you had the rise of anti-colonial movements who didn't want assimilation and transformation. They wanted independence. There were some Vietnamese who bought the idea of assimilation. We can talk about that tomorrow. But certainly the thrust of Vietnamese thinking going into the 20s and 30s was to reject assimilation and to, in effect, reject both association and assimilation on the part of many of them, and to promote independence. But I don't know whether this is something that any of you would like to do, but as I said, it's a way of talking about what it is the French were trying to do. Not might say, well, the French were simply trying to make money, but the point is they did have a philosophy. Just as it's possible to criticize the United States and say we were just there for our own interests, but there was thinking in the White House, in the foreign affairs of agencies in the United States, a kind of philosophy, or at least there was thinking about what we were trying to do, and it sets up some ideas that you can develop later. I think I often ask students, suppose you're in that situation, which if you were a Frenchman, which would you prefer? And the natural tendency, I think, of most students has been to say association is better because, of course, as individualists, we tend to, most Americans respect other societies, and I think rightfully so. But one of the things I'll point out is that there's a kind of dark side to the philosophy of association, and that is that many people who preferred association to assimilation preferred it not simply because they felt that the Vietnamese had a right to their own tradition, but because they felt that the Vietnamese weren't up to becoming Frenchmen. In other words, it's this old, you've heard the idea of social Darwinism. I usually bring in the idea of social Darwinism, the ladder of evolution, and that some of the attitudes about association were simply that the Vietnamese can't make it as French, and therefore, who cares? Let's just exploit them and be done with it. So, whether or not that's something you get into, you may not do it. But as I said, that's usually one of the periods in the beginning of, as we begin moving up toward the war, when a lot of the students really begin to get into the concepts of what's going on here. And then it's, as I said, it's something that I usually like to go back to later when we get into the American period and say, well,
thank you.
terms of actual French colonial policies, there are probably so many different ways to deal with this, and some of you have probably a lot more experience in it, and maybe from a different perspective than I do. I talk about French colonial policy primarily in terms, on the one hand, of political reform or political change and economic change. And I try to use the philosophy of colonialism as a kind of test plate to evaluate French policy. In other words, I start off by saying, okay, this is what they claimed they were trying to do in terms of, for example, in terms of, let's say, assimilation, which was their policy during the good deal. What were they trying to do? And I would point out that at least in a theoretical manner, they were trying to introduce the Vietnamese people to democratic institutions. And then I would talk about the nature of French policy in political terms. And I would also compare it in another way with traditional society. In other words, I would say, what are some of the basic characteristics of some of the characteristics that we would describe for traditional political institutions and political culture, and then say, and try to sort of weave that in as well. And I will try to give you a blow-by-blow description of the way that it works out. But certainly one of the things has to be pointed out that the French, in actuality, were very reluctant to grant the kinds of political reforms that, of course, the basic idea of assimilation would have called for. And I don't go into a lot of detail on political institutions because I find that students are very interested in it and they don't remember it very well. So I usually talk about it in very general terms, in terms of the very gradual and reluctant establishment of advisory assemblies, municipal councils, political bodies of that type in the three regions of Vietnam. And I point out that they were generally advisory rather than policy making. They were also formed on the basis of a very limited franchise. Many of them would start out as, in the case of the municipal council in Saigon, for example, it was a majority of French, and only gradually did it evolve into a majority of Vietnamese. Even where the Vietnamese were enfranchised, in effect, it was a very limited vote based on the payment of tax. So I tried to show, in other words, just in a very general way, the reluctance, and for very obvious reasons, of the French to grant the kind of political liberties which were, of course, the basis of French policy back home. In economic sense, I tend to divide it between urban reforms and rural ones. In the urban area, relationship a little bit. I'll talk a little bit about the traditional nature of the agricultural system, the fact that you didn't have a commercial system, so that people were driven off the land, and for the most part, that people had a certain amount of tenure on the land, even though the amount of land that they might have might be small, and the amount of rent that they would pay would be fairly large. So that you had a system which, in effect, sort of preserved the farmer on the land. It didn't drive him off, but it didn't give him much chance to prosper. You can get into more detail on that when I'm trying to cut down things on it. What the French, of course, do is bring in a commercialized system, based, of course, in part on the desire to collect taxes, to make the system self-supporting, and secondly, on the idea to produce export products, which, of course, will benefit the colony as a whole, as well as individual exporters. And one of the things that I will usually get into is the whole case of the draining of the swamps in the Mekong Delta, an area, of course, which had traditionally been fairly marshy. You get near the coast, the backup of the salt water meant that productivity there was relatively low. I haven't done a lot of work in this, but I know that the governments before the French had been working on clearing the marshes and made some progress on it. But there seems no doubt, based on what I've seen, that the French could point with a fair amount of pride to the fact that they had put some thousands of acres in the Mekong Delta into productivity because of the various kinds of irrigation works that they were able to introduce. There again, this is something that other people might present in a different way. In fact, I will usually quote my father-in-law. I guess we all have stories that we use to make a point. My father-in-law was born and raised in France, became an American citizen, went out to Vietnam with me as a member of one of the research corporations, a group called ARPA, which was very active in Vietnam at the time. And he and I used to get in massive arguments about the French, because he would say, well, the Americans have messed it up, but the French did a pretty good job. And I'd say, Marcel, what are you talking about? And he'd say, well, just look at what the French did. Rice exports increased dramatically under the French. And he would point to the fact that, I guess, in the best years of the mid-20s or something, it was something like 2 million metric tons of rice were being exported every year. And of course, rice production was up during this period. Well, if you've read Buttinger, and I expect many of you have, of course, he's a well-known critic of the French regime, and you have to use him with a little care. The explanation of a lot of this is that it was a matter of distribution rather than simply production. What happened in the Mekong Delta was that as the land was cleared, it was opened up for sale, and in many cases sold off to a relatively small number of reasonably well-to-do South Vietnamese, who then would invite in or employ some of the poorer peasants who migrated from Central and North Vietnam down to the South to work as tenants in these areas. And the end result was, of course, a very high rate of tenancy in the Mekong or the Delta, fairly high rates of rents were fairly high. I mean, these are some of the sort of standard statistics that you will see in many books, and I've always been a little bit uncomfortable in using some of these because I keep waiting for somebody to come up with some definitive evidence, because everybody is always quoting everybody else's figure. And I don't know, some of you may be acquainted with this, but there's a famous statistic that I often use and I tell the students, I'm not sure how true it is, but it's probably reasonably true, is that something like 2.5% of the population in South Vietnam in the 1950s and 1960s owned about 50% of the irrigable land in the country, and the rate of tenancy was very high. So what happens in this case, and you can do the same thing, of course, with the export of rubber, which is another example money or as a possession into a money-making proposition, although some of you may have seen a book produced about 5 or 6 years ago by a French scholar who says that in actuality it wasn't really a paid proposition. It was, it made well for a small number of Frenchmen, but for France as a whole, it really wasn't very productive. I don't usually get into that because that's neither here nor there in terms of the way I teach the war. But the problem created for the French in a way was that they created a structure which exacerbated the inequalities, drove many peasants off the land. A small number of peasants, a small number of farmers, a small number of the urban population did benefit and created a small and fairly prosperous urban middle class. You see it primarily in Saigon, but you could see it to lesser degrees in the other urban areas in the country. But in a general way, the per capita income for the population as a whole did not rise, and in fact, I guess there's some evidence that over a period of 20 or 30 years, it probably dropped, and perhaps even precipitously during the Depression. So that you have a very distorted kind of a development. You have the creation of that kind of classical dual economy, where you have a very small and fairly well-developed advanced urban economy with a certain amount of agriculture development in particular cash crop areas, and a relatively stagnant and even declining or deteriorating situation elsewhere. And this is an area, of course, where you can assign some readings to give students a feeling of what it was like to live at that time, and the kind of thing we can get into later. Presented is this, in trying to conclude on the colonial period, and I will usually put it in the context of the industrialization process in almost any society, and try to point out the fact that the industrialization process, in the first place, it's a very difficult transition period for any country. It's certainly a difficult transitional process when you have a fairly large and relatively poor agricultural population. And I mentioned that it is usually the farmer above all who pays the price for the industrialization process, in the sense that he does a lot of the work and he gets very few of the rewards. And what usually happens, and of course you can use any number of examples, is that as modernization of agriculture takes place, whether it's either mechanization, of course, in some cases, or the development of cash crops, the poorer farmers are driven off the land. And they're, as you say, they have to go somewhere. And in the case of Vietnam, insofar as this happened, I'm sure some of them went to the cities, although I haven't really seen any figures. I haven't read carefully some of the classic French studies on this to look into it, but certainly the logic of the situation is that people driven off the land, if they're not tenants and just sort of scrabbling by, but if they're literally driven off the land and find nowhere to go, they become plantation workers, or they would go into the cities looking for jobs. And in the classical transformation process, if it's working effectively, within a generation or so, these people will find jobs in the urban economy because the urban economy is beginning to develop. I mean, you can see this happening in Japan, I guess. Some of you may be more knowledgeable than I am, but there's about a one-generation lag where the farmers were having an awful lot of trouble in Japan. But as the industrial sector caught on, you have that move, you know, first one step in the factory and then two steps in the factory, and you have the creation of an urban middle class and an urban proletariat. And the city, the country begins to reach a takeoff point. And what I usually use that to try to go back to the earlier stage, and I say this did not happen in Indochina because there was nothing to do in the cities. In other words, the logic of the situation would have been that an urban sector would have been developing in Vietnam, which would have absorbed enough of this labor and created a fairly dynamic urban bourgeoisie and a working class. And because of the French unwillingness to allow that process, you have a situation that stagnates. I don't know, some of you may have read a fairly well-known book by Clifford Geertz. It's called Agricultural Involution. And he deals with the economy in the Dutch East Indies. And I got some of my ideas from him because the way he puts it, he said that all countries suffer through the industrialization process. And as he said it, in the Dutch East Indies, the problem was they suffered for nothing because the Dutch, like the French, did not allow the development of a local industrial and commercial sector which would absorb these people and allow that process to develop. So, as he says it, the Dutch East Indies was caught in a permanent state of transition. The old system was being destroyed, and there was nothing new being created in its place. And I think that you can make pretty much the same case in Indochina, that the French simply were unwilling to allow the transference from one sector to another. And that's, you know, that leads me to a kind of general conclusion on colonialism. I'm not one of these people who likes to get up on a soapbox, except within my own family, then I'll soapbox all the time. Kids say, oh, Dad, you're sermonizing again, but in a classroom, I don't like to do it. So I don't say colonialism is lousy. You know, I must admit, I do all the things that try to that show that it didn't do its job, but I don't come right out and say it. And I try to make the point that I think a case can be made that that in various ways colonial systems helped to speed up the modernization process, whatever that means. And I'm willing to give a certain amount of credit insofar as it existed. But I guess what I